Welcome to episode 127 of the Get Cyber Resilient Show. Today is our Behind the Cyber News edition of the show. I'm Dan McDermott, your host, and I'm joined by our resident cybersecurity experts, Garrett O'Hara and Vin Yuan. Today, we will begin by looking into the announcement from the Home Affairs Department to restructure in order to give the government a cyber spine. Next, we will dive into the plan from the European Central Bank to run stress tests of cyber resilience across Europe's top banks following the sharp rise in cyber attacks over the past 12 months. And our final deep dive story is a look at a new bootkit malware called Black Lotus and the risk that it poses. And we'll end with a wrap of the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. Gar and Vin, welcome back to the podcast. And as always, there's plenty of news headlines for us to delve behind. Gar, let's begin by taking a look at the latest announcement from the Home Affairs Minister, Claire O'Neill, on the department's restructuring and how this will help create a so-called cyber spine for the federal government.
Cyber spine. That's a cool... Somebody's going to trademark that and we're going to have probably a new product, eh? Cyber spine. It's happening around the world, right? I mean, we saw the US releasing their cyber strategy. I think what's happening here kind of makes sense. The rejigging of the DAJ, and I think what it is acknowledging how much the risk has changed for Australia, the citizens, the businesses, the governments, and DAJ now kind of reflecting more of the cybersecurity concerns, whether it's breaches or foreign interference type stuff, influence attacks as they call them, and I think it fits in perfectly with that sense that I think most people who have, kind of tuned into the news would have around the geopolitics and just a general sense of nations kind of circling the wagons, borders going up, much more concentration on inward concentration, I suppose, by most countries. I think Claire is often saying what many folks in our cybersecurity industry have been thinking for kind of a long time, which is really that, it's a big problem and we're probably behind where we need to be. I'd say that's at an industry level and also at a kind of national level, that it is serious. And, while we haven't really seen the big thing that many people are waiting for, it could be only a matter of time. And I know I kind of bleed on about the CNI stuff a lot and just, that worrying that could be. But I think Claire is spot on in just getting the DAJ kind of lined up behind this properly and making cybersecurity more of a focus and doing it now. And that's the thing I would say about what I've seen from her so far. I'm sure you kind of think, well, it's just saber rattling, but this is it's happening quite quickly. Like some of the changes that she's putting in place and some of the changes within the DAJ, but also the kind of the coordination that she's looking to get in place at a national level. That sort of stuff, I think, is actually quite important. And again, reflects what's happening around the world. Like Australia is not unique in this. It's the same in the UK, same in the US, etc.
Yeah, an interesting part of this is the notion of this new role that they're setting up around the Coordinator for Cybersecurity. And got a pretty big task ahead of them, looking at, the structure, strategy, what they need to do, and being able to actually say, this is a quote from Claire, are the billions of dollars being spent on cyber actually being spent in the right way as well? So it's going to be interesting to see, the appointment of that person and how they can manage, across that, and then they'd be able to effectively, measure some of the effectiveness of the spend that the government's put in place. So it sounds like some accountability coming to the notions that are happening as well.
And accountability, that is so important, right? I think that's the thing. There's a lot of money sloshes around in governments, in every government. It's not an Australian thing, obviously, but to your point, Dan, there's so much bureaucracy and layers that are involved in government, whether that's kind of, federal, state, or local. I think that accountability part is actually really, really important. And, we've seen time and again, right, when the audits happen, how far off government organizations and entities are from stated goals, whether that's alignment to ASD or, the general audits that happen for cybersecurity. So I think, the double-pronged approach of, first of all, getting the coordination in place at a national level. That's going to be fantastic. And, you know, the analogy I was thinking of earlier today was when 9/11 happened in the US, one of the things that was kind of very obvious was that there was a weakness that existed, not through the work of individual agencies, but actually the kind of overarching view of cyber and, you know, well, sorry, at the with 9/11, the three-letter agencies were all potentially doing really good work, but it just took somebody to have the conversation and integrate the intel between them to potentially get to a better outcome. Cyber is the same. I think you and I actually spoke about this a couple of years ago. Was there, there was a statement to Parliament, and sort of buried in one of the documents there was the fragmented nature of the reporting that was happening. And that's years ago. I can't even remember what the, I think it was the statement of Parliament, something like that on cyber. So many PDFs, so little time. It's hard to remember. But I do remember you and I talking about that. Like what a weakness that is when you think about the metrics that are being reported on. They're so fragmented. There's no unified view of where we're at, where the spend is being effective or not being effective. So I think that's a really good sort of outcome of this. And then also from an incident response perspective as well, that integrated, coordinated approach to what that looks like. I think that's going to be really, really important as well. I mean, the sort of lighthearted comment is, I think they need a better title because coordinated, I think it's coordinated for cyber resilience, I think was the title or something like that.
Yeah, coordinated for cyber security.
Man, they need Commander of the Night Watch. We need something a bit more punchy for a role that is that important. That's obviously, I'm just kidding there. I mean, I think the function is so important to get this right. And as you say, it's a huge remit and a huge amount of responsibility. But from what I've read, it looks like this is stuff that they're looking to get in place as early as next month, which is beautiful, right? This isn't a, you know, we're doing the evaluation to set up the committee to have the discussion around the potential for a steering committee. Like, they're actually doing stuff, which is, it's heartening, you know, good times.
Yeah, I wonder how long it'll take for this coordinator for cybersecurity to be the most popular person in the cybersecurity, given the massive budget and spend they're going to have, I guess, being told the strategy. And it's great to hear that they're only a month out, but, you know, if they had more time, I would have said, hey, God, Dan, like, if you ever needed a referral, I'm more than happy to kind of vouch for you guys to jump in, throw your hat in the ring.
I would be so bad at that job. It's not even funny.
We'll give you a different challenge, Gar. I think it would be like looking forward to having them as a guest on the podcast.
So definitely do that.
That'd be cool.
Give you that one.
Look, this stuff, I don't know what you guys think, but it's starting to feel more and more every time, you know, we talk on the news episodes. But like when you track it over probably year over year, the importance at a national level is just, it's going up and up all the time in a really constructive, I would think, way. And sort of reflecting on some of the stuff that came out of the US strategy, which was last week or the week before, where some of it's like, it's pretty solid stuff. And like, I think in their case, they're doing things around, you know, you almost think about pushing the toothpaste back in the tube with some of it, where, you know, for so many years, and we've talked about this, you know, the idea that, you know, companies are pushed to grow rather than be secure. And, you know, that's the free markets just doing what free markets will, which is, you know, kind of grow at all expenses and, you know, externalize costs to your users and take the risks with data. And you're starting to see some of the stuff with the US strategy where some of their pillars around, I should have this in front of me, but, you know, it's basically how do you get the industry and the market to do the right thing by national cyber resilience and the issues that we've actually talked about on this with, well, in the news episodes. I know we spoke about it with Dmitry Alperovich yonks ago around things like IoT and, you know, how the market drives towards cheap stuff that you can put in place. But, you know, they're released with, you know, username and password of admin and zero security, but, you know, it's an awesome little IP connected security camera or, you know, a kettle that, I don't know, what could you do in a kettle? A kettle that, you know, tells your phone what temperature the water's at and when the tea is ready or, you know, whatever. But, you know, but now starting to see a little bit of pushback on that stuff where, and it's going to take, it's not like this is instant, but, you know, you're going to start to see the hopefully the slow change in markets through this kind of stuff where you now have to kind of do IoT well and you have to I don't know, align to sort of, I don't know, NIST or software development life cycles or ISO or whatever it is, but like good security practices as you're developing products. So yeah, I think it's around the world, some good stuff happening with this at the governments.
Yeah, and it's obviously all around the stated notion of wanting Australia to be the most cyber secure country in the world by 2030. And I guess, you know, when you look at that, we've sort of laughed a couple of times around, like, you know, well, lucky by 2030 because I heard the big attacks coming in 2031. That's what they're planning for. So, like, we should be okay, which is good. And the second part is how do you know that you're the most secure? How do you rank? And it's really interesting that MIT have actually just released a report around this. So MIT, the famed, obviously, university out of Boston, have just done a research study around the G20 countries in the world, minus Russia and including Poland, and done a survey of 50 CISOs from each country around 16 different sort of pillars and contributing factors that they're looking at around trying to get an understanding of sort of where does each nation sort of fit in terms of their strategies, their approaches, their resilience at a government, organizational, and sort of person level. And they actually looked at four core pillars as part of it. One is that one we spoke about, Gar, around CNI, around critical infrastructure and what is being done around that. Second is around the resourcing for cybersecurity and what is in place for that. The third pillar is around organizations' capacity. So are boards prioritizing spend? Is it actually seen as an important aspect? And is there the focus around it from an organizational perspective? And the fourth pillar is around policy commitment. So things that you said, like around regulatory, we spoke about, you know, the privacy changes coming and all of those type of things. So there's those four pillars. And they did this survey and have actually ranked all of the nations. And on top, despite all of failing ASD audits and everything else, on top of the rankings is Australia. So Australia placed first in this report. It's called the Cyber Defence Index. So we were number one on that. And it reflects the efforts to make robust digital infrastructure widely available. And it talks about the fact that the Australian government strives to use digital tools and regulations to safeguard personal data and digital transaction. And it's committed to overhauling cybersecurity laws, pledging to shelve previous roadmaps that, you know, maybe weren't going to be effective. And really has also highlights the importance of this and the reaction since, like, the Optus breach that gets called out as well. So if anybody's interested in reading more on the MIT report and where different nations fit, it's really interesting to see Australia coming out on top. Netherlands was number two, by the way. Interesting to sort of see where we fit and how, I guess, the gaps that we know that still exist, yet, you know, relatively speaking, seem like so far our CISO community thinks that, you know, as organizations and as a government, we're doing a reasonable job.
We need the edit to include the national anthem in the background as you're going through that, Dan. You know, feel a burst of patriotism there that we're doing so well. It's awesome news, though. Maybe they have a Cyber Olympics in the future. You know, we could start getting some gold medals under our belts.
We love a gold medal, so yeah. Why not? We'll move on to our next story. And it was something that you sort of spoke about a little bit around, like, how do you test for cyber resilience and how do you sort of raise the standards? And the next story is around the European Central Bank looking to stress test the cyber resilience of European banks. Finn, how can a sort of central bank play a role in cybersecurity?
I guess given that it's a central bank, it looks after a lot of little banks underneath it, right? The European Central Bank, if you kind of compare it to the Reserve Bank of Australia, I guess it's a bank's bank, right, in financial terms. But essentially what they're doing is they're looking at stress testing. And under the European Central Bank, there's actually 111 that kind of falls underneath it. But essentially just giving them an idea of how these banks would be able to first respond and also react to a potential cybersecurity incident. Now, it was the European Central Bank's supervisory chief, Andrea Enria, who did talk about how they were going to test this through a through a thematic stress test. So when I heard stress test, I was like, okay, with all the bells and whistles, there's going to be like people running in and out. It's going to be like a full tabletop exercise. They're only in the process of now thinking of the scenario. And then we'll go out to 111 of those banks and say, great, this is a scenario. Please respond to us within the year how you would, one, react, but also respond and also recover. So those are the metrics of it. I don't think there's any more insight into, obviously not the scenario, but also what's expected in terms of their reports or the results. But it's something that will be interesting to see. And I think more interesting is the timing of it too. Now, Andre did mention that it was based off, you know, what's been happening with, say, Russia and Ukraine, and there's been an increase in cyber attacks coming through. So it's just a very interesting time to, like, why now to test, you know, top bank cyber resilience? Obviously, the increased number of attacks has something to play with it, but it's been done before, this type of stress test, right? You know, we had the Bank of England last year. You also did a voluntary stress test. It was like, all right, you know, who wants to participate can? And the Federal Reserve in the US also do it quite often as well. So, yeah, it'll be interesting to see, like, what comes out of this one.
It's really interesting that, like you say, it's sort of like a central sort of authority taking that role to try to raise the bar for and the standard for everybody, right? As part of the, you know, who they look after. So it's definitely interesting that they're taking such a proactive approach to trying to make sure that it is top of mind, that it's there, and it is part of, you know, the best practices that are required, as we know, you know, how critical cyber is, of course, in sort of financial services.
Yeah, it's about the accountability, which Guy mentioned before, right? And that's goal, right? You need someone to say, like, we're raise our hand, like, we're going to be responsible, because, you know, obviously these banks report up to the European Central Bank. So who better than the person at the very top?
Seems like there's a theme here, isn't there? Where you let certain organizations kind of eventually try and get to it themselves, and they don't. But as soon as, yeah, to Vin's point, somebody central comes in with a bit of authority and a, you know, more bite than bark. Yeah, it's amazing how quickly stuff can happen.
And there's a mutual interest, yeah, right? I mean, like Andre did call out as part of it, it's like one of the big concerns for them is the fact that a lot of the banks are actually outsourcing a lot of their critical IT infrastructure to outside providers. And it could be outside providers outside their own team, obviously, but it could also be outside providers from other parts of the world too. And more recently, it was actually the Irons Markets breach. So they're a SaaS-based company out of the UK who essentially help a lot of financial institutions actually do things like transactions and, you know, a lot of that type of stuff. And they actually got done by a group called Lockbit, which I think we've spoken on the pod before, a Russian kind of criminal gang who's out to kind of get PII and that type of information and kind of sell it on the dark web. But there's a flow-on effect, right? And I guess like at the very top, like that's gives it the most room to kind of flow down and affect everyone else. So it's in their best interest to make sure that, hey, we're all secure, but what's the best way to do it? Let's get a thematic stress test out, see where everyone's at, and from there you can kind of plan on what's the best next step to ensure everyone's more secure and cyber resilient.
Indeed. Well, definitely strong steps being taken in the right direction by a lot of sort of these regulators and central sort of providers to really up game for everybody. Our final deep dive story for this episode is how the Black Lotus malware can bypass important Windows boot functions. Gar, what is Black Lotus and what's the risk that this poses for organizations?
So it's an interesting one, I think, for signals around October last year, where this thing was getting kind of spruiked on the dark web and hacker forums. And it basically is interesting because, you know, it was sort of not theoretical, but it was mythical is the wrong word as well. It wasn't necessarily confirmed that it was real, I suppose. But it pretty much has been confirmed now that it's the first kind of in the wild boot kit that's able to bypass the secure boot in UEFI. So that, like, UEFI is the kind of replacement for BIOSes. If anyone remembers building machines back in the day where you'd have to, you know, get the BIOS sorted, then plug in all your stuff. Vin's smiling because he's probably built a bunch of gaming machines over the years, I suspect. You know, UEFIs or Unified Extensible Firmware Interfaces, the, you know, the full name for that, but it's basically the kind of new rock and roll when it comes to the thing that talks between the hardware and, you know, ultimately the operating system, so firmware for devices. and all that good stuff. Secure boot is a, like in theory, is a way to make sure that the machine, well, sort of in the name, isn't it? Boots securely. the marketing team went bananas on that one, and the whiteboarding and the name selection.
Imagine the options that they went through and just, you know, like, should we just call it Secure Boot? That's a good idea.
Yeah, what a, it's like, wasn't there a movie years ago? It was a little side trail where the sort of idea was that a guy got really successful in marketing because he basically just used honesty. So like, you know, Volvo, they're boxy, but they're good. You know, is that that sort of stuff?
It would never catch on. Honesty in marketing. Come yeah.
But yeah, look, this thing is like, it's basically an industry standard. And as so many of these things do, it uses cryptography to, in theory, make sure that all the things that the UEFI and the machine needs to kind of get booted up and ready to rock and roll is trusted. And, you know, it's fairly standard stuff. It can use as signatures, as so many of the things that we do and use today are based on. So that idea that if you've got a trusted signature, like a digital signature or certificates, and, you know, when you go to websites, it's sort of the same idea. But as you boot, you can check that the signatures are valid and okay, and away you go. So in theory, like, it's a good way to approach this. And what you're trying to protect here is kind of ring zero kernel stuff. If you guys are kind of familiar with that, it's the heart of the security in a machine. Like, if you get into ring zero, and as you go further out, the rings kind of have higher numbers and they're less critical or core to security. So by the time you get into compromising kind of ring zero stuff, it's pretty serious. It's a pretty huge vulnerability. And that's what, you know, in theory, that's what this thing is doing. It's getting in at that level and able to bypass the secure boot to get to the point where you can compromise the machine and start to do things like HTTP downloads and, you know, all that kind of good stuff. It's a really interesting one. So the CVE that it's, a vulnerability that it's based on has been patched already. So you kind of think, well, okay, what's going on here? You know, it's patched, and there's a thing called a revocation list. It exists in certificates as well for internet sites. So the idea being that on a trust chain, as you go from like the top level down, if something breaks along the way, you can kind of revoke the certificate. And in theory, then if somebody tries to go and use that certificate, the, you know, the machine says, the computer says no.
No.
Yeah, because, okay, well, you know, we've got a thing that has been revoked. So the problem with this stuff is that if you sort of use the revocation list, the potential impact is you kind of brick or make a bunch of machines that, you know, potentially could have otherwise booted not boot anymore. So it's not as simple as just, you know, publish the list and away you go. It's actually got pretty significant implications. So I think there's been a little bit of, it's kind of a funny one. You know, the fix exists, or sorry, the patch exists for the vulnerability, but it's hard to kind of use it because of the impact or the potential impact to a bunch of unknown machines that are out there that could be involved in potentially critical stuff. So end result is that this Black Lotus thing is out there, and it's actually, you know, the headline is you can potentially be running on, you know, fully up-to-date Windows 11 systems with UEFI that has secure boot. So you've done all the right things and you're potentially still vulnerable because of how this thing is built.
And have we seen it turn up anywhere? Has it actually had an impact so far?
Well, so ESET are the ones doing the kind of, I suppose, the detailed research. So everyone, I'm sure, is familiar with ESET. So like it's around as far as the actual, you know, sort of the scope or the impact so far. I honestly don't know the answer to that one. I haven't actually read anything about that so far. Maybe Vayanaz, I'm not sure. But it, you know, it's sort of in the wild, and I think that's the thing. Like if it's out there, yeah, like it's a thing to be worried about. It's as simple as that, really. Like I say, it's been spruced on the internet since, I think it was last October, but correct me if I'm wrong on that one. Where the folks who sell these things are, like, they're selling it for thousands of dollars. and, you know, kind of telling the buyers like what it can do, what it's good for. And but in and of itself, that's probably the thing to worry about. If it's been on sale since last year, then, you know, you'd assume along the way people somewhere along the way have actually gone and bought it and are actually potentially out there using it. And interestingly, like in theory, it's capable of actually disabling some of the operating system level security mechanisms that are there. So if people are using things like BitLocker for encrypting their hard drive and things like Windows Defender, then, you know, in theory, you can disable those. So it's certainly like a serious one, and then sort of one to be worried about, I suppose. Added to the long list of things to be worried about when it comes to cyber, but, you know, it's definitely out there. And unless you're actually... Maybe don't worry about it if you're from a subset of the countries that apparently it doesn't proceed with the bootkit installation. So if you're in Russia or Ukraine, Belarus, Armenia, Romania, there's a few countries where apparently it sort of it doesn't actually proceed with the bootkit installation. So maybe those folks can go to sleep at night and not worry so much about this one.
Very good. Well, both our listeners in Armenia will sleep well tonight, which is good.
I thought we were huge in Armenia, no?
I think we have had a play there, but maybe not huge. Finally, let's wrap up with a quick review on the latest breaches and vulnerabilities to make the headlines. The first news item is how the Australian National Maritime Museum has been hit by an alleged trusted insider. Vin, what's happened here?
I had to Google search where the actual Maritime Museum was. I don't think I've ever been to one before. It's a whole lot of boats and stuff. But in this particular case, as we've seen time and time again, a third-party IT contractor who's working at the Australian National Maritime Museum has been accessing their accounting system and doing a little bit of forensic investigation and done some naughty stuff where they've gone ahead and, you know, did things like change bank account details, thorn the system. They access, I guess, individual and business details to help authorize some transactions through. So they're obviously buying some stuff. Not sure if they were Louis Vuitton bags or not then, but it did amount to a grand total of around $90,000 of what the police have pulled up there. And I will say, going back to my prediction at the very start, I think it's going to happen. I generally think there's going to be a stage where someone gets enticed and paid enough where they will actually make a mistake. I mean, this one wasn't necessarily it, but it's human arrogance, right? People are tempted, right? The fact that they can try get away with, you know, buying all this stuff with a lot of money. Yeah, it's just, how do we fix this? I don't know, but it's been investigated by the AFP. They've gone to this person's house. They've gone ahead and grabbed all this stuff like laptops and the likes of to get evidence. But yeah, just another instance to show that crime doesn't pay.
Indeed. And we've spoken many times about, you know, insider threat, right? And how difficult that is to detect and to stop, right? And so obviously they've done a good job of actually pinning this one down and being able to put a halt to it.
Mm-hmm.
Next is the latest stats from the OAIC on the number of notifiable data breaches from the second half of last year. And to no one's surprise, the numbers are on the rise. Gar, just how many breaches were reported?
So nearly 500, or as a normal human being would say, 500 viable data breaches in the second half of last calendar year. What's interesting, or may I just use the word interesting, maybe loosely when it comes to OAIC stuff, but this was released based on a Freedom of Information request. So it's actually before the... You know, I suppose the official breach report that they do release on a fairly regular basis. And it's interesting, Dan, like when we were talking about this at the very start, I was pretty keenly, like, you know, opening the report, see what was changing, what was new. And it actually felt like the stats were relatively static in terms of, you know, the types of things that were happening, you know, and the numbers were not flatlined, but they didn't seem to jiggle around too much. Whereas, you know, for this one, yeah, it's a 26% increase compared to 2020. So, like, that's not insignificant, I suppose. But yeah, it was, yeah, certainly interested to see that. The data, yeah, it was basically released based on an FOI rather than, you know, the sort of normal cadence release that happens. And I think it was actually released with segment data that wasn't traditionally part of the report also. So you could start to see at a bit more of a granular level how specific segments or kind of vertical types were doing, which I think is also kind of an interesting part of this as well.
It's fascinating that somebody's gone to the effort of putting in a Freedom of Information request for a report that comes out, you know, shortly anyway. Like, I'm not sure like what the intention there was. Is almost to gazump the release of the report.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows what the idea was? I don't know if it was that they were looking for the segment data, which isn't traditionally included. So I don't know if the FOI was that. And as a result, they got the sort of roll-up data also. I don't actually know.
Interesting. Well, hopefully, I think this full report will be out shortly as well. So we'll be able to review all of the details from the OAIC then. Finally, the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, or CBA, has been hit by a cyber attack at their Indonesian operations. Finn, what happened to CBA?
So it's the CBA Indonesian subsidiary PC Bank. So no need for like mass panic and you're a CBA customer right around. No. So PC Bank, so the Indonesian subsidiary was hit by a cyber attack, as said on Wednesday, I think that was when it was. So there's no impact to any customers in Australia. So deep breath, like we're okay for now. Unless obviously you bank with PC Bank, then maybe get in touch with them. But it's only understood that the details of about 11, I guess, of their customers might have been accessed by an external intruder. There isn't too much information outside of that, but we do know that the CBA did make an announcement to the ASX saying they're aware of a cyber incident, and it relates to unauthorized access of a software application third party used for project management. And I believe it's Atlassian's Jira. So the European Central Bank are onto something, right? Yeah, outsourcing a lot of your stuff and you gotta protect your supply chain. Wu-Tang Clan logo. It's common practice, right? Especially within the financial industry that, you have your systems segregated based off where you are. So the Australian instance is Australia and everything that happens outside of that is away from that. So what we have been told is that services will continue to operate as per normal, but just another instance of how supply chain can potentially, if it was connected, could have resulted into something bigger. So, luckily not Medibank and Optus and CBA. It's just a subsidiary of CBA for now.
Very good. Well, like you say, anybody banking in Indonesia with PT Bank, get in contact and protect your data and your finances.
I guess like as part of this as well, like it'll be interesting to see like what comes, because it's still pretty fresh too. But in terms of how that credential got leaked, or was it leaked, and who accessed it? Was it someone who wasn't supposed to internally, or was it someone external who was meaning harm as well? So it's early days, but I think like transparency is extremely important. Talking about things like the notifiable data breach and having more insight and learning from the rest of the industry, like this could be a great learning moment if they choose to share it. But depending on how CBA kind of go ahead with this, not sure it falls under Australian jurisdictions being in Indonesia, but yeah. I'll keep a close eye on this one and update everyone accordingly.
Terrific. Thank you. And thanks, Vin and Gar, for your insights into another big news episode today. Gar, who do you have as our special guest for next week?
So next week is David Higgins, who was the, until fairly recently, the CISO for Kiwi Bank. He's taken a career break. Vin and myself met David actually over in New Zealand when we were at the CyberSec Con that was run by ChiliSoft. And I think, anybody in sort of New Zealand, I think will know David. He's an awesome guy. He gave a phenomenal talk at CyberSec Con. And like I say, right now he's kind of leading by example and taking a bit of a break from cyber. But we got into a conversation around AI and ChatGPT, obviously, and what that means for cyber. What it means from the attacker side and also the protector side. And he's pretty good at kind of getting through to what's hype and what's real. So really interesting guy full of energy and full of heart, so definitely want to tune into.
Terrific. Yeah, looking forward to hearing from David next week. And until then, if you'd like to continue exploring key topics in cybersecurity, please jump onto getcyberresilient.com and check out some of the latest articles, including a full wrap-up of the news headlines from February with our This Month in Security article, and a look into why the answer to cyber's talent shortage could be staring CISOs right in the face. Thanks for listening, and until next time, stay safe.